And now we are going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors.
Hey everyone, this is Patrick with All Things Private Practice. I wanted to just give a huge shout out for The Receptionist for iPad. They've been a sponsor for this podcast for 4 years in a row, and I just want to say how grateful I am to their partnership and what they do for the not only therapist, but also medical community. Your time is valuable. Whether you're hyper-focused on admin tasks like billing or simply trying to make a cup of coffee between appointments or trying to use the bathroom, constant interruptions can derail your entire day. This episode and this year's podcast is sponsored by The Receptionist, a sign-in app company. The Receptionist for iPad is a HIPAA-ready digital check-in system that eliminates the need to walk back and forth from your office to the waiting room to see if your next appointment has arrived. Clients or patients can check in for their appointments, and you'll be immediately notified by text, email, or your preferred channel. Break free from the interruptions and make the most of your time, because it is valuable. Start a free 14-day trial of The Receptionist for iPad by going to thereceptionist.com/private practice. Make sure to start your trial with that link, and you'll also get your first month free if you decide to sign up. Hey everyone, welcome back to the All Things Private Practice podcast. I'm joined today by Angela R. Howard, who is a globally recognized equity-centered organizational culture and change strategist who speaks, writes, and advocates for the transformative power of work in driving social impact. As the founder of Call for Culture, a strategic advisory firm and community of practice, Angela helps organizations align, mobilize, and transform into humane, people-centered workplaces and create meaningful and lasting change. A former executive leader and head of people and culture, Angela has a firsthand experience navigating organizations through complex culture transformations. She has witnessed how the workplace often lags behind societal and generational shifts and how unsustainable approaches to change can negatively impact both people and profit. Leveraging her expertise, Angela has guided organizations worldwide to build sustainable, adaptive, and responsive workplace cultures. She has a master's in industrial and organizational psychology and lives in the Chicagoland area. Her team leads Call for Culture's annual Culture Impact Conference. I just read that wrong. And her team leads Call for Culture's annual Culture Impact Conference. This event brings together culture changemakers to address challenges at the intersection of social impact in the workplace, fostering a vision for a more equitable, inclusive, and just future of work. Thanks so much. That's a cool bio. I really like that a lot.
Thanks, Patrick, and thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Shout out to Kendra, who might be listening right now for the connection.
Hey, girl.
So I think you're the first master's in organizational, like industrial psychology that we've had on here. And I'm always fascinated by that perspective because your background is really in like looking at how organizations are structured and built and designed to best support the well-being of the staff, and a really cool perspective to have. So tell us a little bit more about what you're doing. Like that, everything I just read sounds very, very interesting and really unique.
Yeah, I know it's a lot of words, but really what it comes down to is behavior at work and systems level change. So if you think about how the workplace, you know, any institution really has been built, there are systems of inequity. We've built it really around, quite honestly, the exploitation of labor. When you think about the labor movement and, you know, we've talked a lot about DEI over the last decade or so. These were all movements to say, how do we bring dignity, respect, and inclusivity into the system of work, which wasn't built around that initially. Right. So when something is so fundamental and foundational to an organization, it's very hard to change it. So a lot of my work is going in, diagnosing, you know, kind of gaps within the organization, and hint, it's usually leadership that's the issue, because they are perpetuating the behavior and the habits of the things that are harmful to employees most of the time. So, you know, my jam is like systems level change, and that can be done within workplaces, but also other institutions. So the same kind of approach applies.
Absolutely. That's really cool. How often are you going into these places of work and meeting resistance from leadership when you start introducing these topics?
90% of the time. Yeah, it is. It's interesting because typically I'm hired by a leader who, one of two things, right? One is there's something that's causing them pain that is causing them to say, okay, something's happening with our culture. We don't know what it is. Just because it's painful doesn't mean they actually want to change it. Right. So typically they're like, hey, come in and fix it. And usually it's like fix the people versus fix the C-suite or the executive team. And that's where the resistance comes in.
For sure. It almost gives me thoughts of like shows like Bar Rescue and things like that.
Yes, exactly.
Restaurants bleeding money. And it's like, well, we need to change these things. And there's always resistance to that, right? Because I think as humans, we are often sometimes anchored into resistance to change. And I think for leadership, it can probably feel like threatening to be like, we're incompetent. We're not doing things well. There's something wrong with us. And there probably is to some degree a lot of the time, right? So having to be able to bridge that gap and have those conversations in a way where that can land and they can actually implement and incorporate, I think is huge.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a tough process because there is, to your point, the process of change actually mirrors the process of grief, in that we kind of, the human emotions are very similar, where there's like denial and then, you know, you have to go through a period of processing and then acceptance. So I am also kind of carrying leaders through that process as well. And sometimes we get to the end and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we don't reach it and we don't change. And as a partner or consultant coming into an organization, there's only so much I can do unless the leaders are willing to change.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, I agree. And it sounds so fascinating to say like someone would hire you to then be like, yeah, I'm not really interested.
Yeah, no thanks.
And
that's interesting because, you know, during, I think, the height of work around DEI, we were doing really, really well because organizations were put on the spot for this type of work. But a lot of it was performative. So it was more of a PR exercise to say, we've hired these people, we're paying them lots of money and they're doing this great work. Check the box.
Yep.
So one thing that my team and I always focus on is we're very transparent with our process because we take a lot of time in the beginning to talk to the people in the organization. And we always ensure that their voices are included. And what we make clear is that we work for the organization, not for a person. A lot of consulting firms will be, you know, say, well, we have these stakeholders and we have to kind of appease these stakeholders. We go in and say, no, we work for the organization and making it better. And so we take a little bit of a different approach, which isn't appreciated by everybody.
Sure.
So it's been an interesting few years, to say the least.
Yeah. And I bet that this year has been really interesting with the state of our country and attacks on DEI in general. And I imagine that makes things even harder in terms of resistance that could potentially show up in some of these organizations saying like, we want to change, but we don't really want it. We're being told we actually don't have to anymore. Like we're being told that we get in trouble if we do that.
Exactly. Yeah. There's kind of a few different, I guess we had this huge umbrella of people who are doing DEI work and culture work. And now we're finding a few things. One is not everybody was serious about it. It was more of the check the box PR effort. And now they're like, oh, we don't have to do that anymore. Cool.
Right.
We're going to, divest with that investment. Then there's a group of people, like nonprofits, for example, are in a really tough spot because their actual mission is around DEI most of the time. And so they're being attacked just to exist.
Yeah.
And, also being able to pay like legal fees to fight against people filing claims. They don't have that money. So there's kind of a reframing of DEI that this group has to do. We have to call it something different. We have to continue to do the work, but, kind of massage language. And then there's the people who are just doubling down. And I would put myself in that camp. I mean, thankfully, we don't run a government, a government company or like a nonprofit. So we have a little bit more flexibility to still speak up and use our platform around the world.
And I love that, the third point for sure. And I found myself in that camp as well. I want to go back to your first like point, which would have been like, eh, we don't have to do it anymore. Cool. And maybe this was lip service or very performative, check the box, et cetera. Let's talk about what that means for culture. Because like, I think if you are an employee in a organization, whether you are in a group practice or any sort of organization, and they say, you know what, we really don't have these values. These are things that we don't care that much about. Or like, we just create an equal space for everybody, like all lives matter type of shit.
Yep.
So like, what does that do to culture?
It's extremely damaging because, first of all, there's a dissonance between what employees are experiencing and what companies are saying.
Yep.
And I think people are waking up to that fact pretty quickly. Yep. And there is kind of a pushback that we're seeing. And this kind of balance of power, I think, is over the last few years has been very erratic, right? So we had a moment in time with COVID where everyone, you know, was working from home, and there was a lot of, for people who are marginalized in the workplace, this was great because, you know, people with disabilities, people of color, you know, the people who have been marginalized and on the margins of the workplace experience were like, this is great. I don't have to deal with microaggressions. I now have the accommodations that I need. Yeah. And then, you know, the power got rebalanced, right? So everybody come back to the office, and now we have to snap back into the status quo. So I think we're at a very interesting point right now where I believe, even though we're seeing kind of a swing back because of our administration, you know, the lack of focus on human rights and the human experience, I think it's going to pivot. It's going to swing right back. It's just going to take some time.
Sure.
Because there is more of an uprising with the employee base and new generations coming into the workplace saying, we're not dealing with the status quo. Absolutely. And one of the things I talk a lot about, and it just drives me a little nutty, is, you know, every generation, we have this big conversation about them, right? Gen Z, I'm a millennial. So we, at some point, we were the hot topic.
Yep.
Now it's Gen Z, and it's the same conversation, right? Oh my gosh, they don't want to work. They're entitled. They're lazy. We've literally been having this conversation since the 1800s.
Yep.
There's a Reddit thread. If anyone is interested, I'd be happy to share you the link, but it's a list of newspaper clippings since 1894. And they all sound the same. And it's like, nobody wants to work. And it's always around a point in time where we're asking for progress and we're asking for dignity and respect in the work we do. And so I know I'm giving you lots of information here, but
I love your question
about culture. We are at a breaking point of what is acceptable. And even though the old norms are still kind of holding on, I believe we're at a point of a revolution and evolution that we haven't seen since the labor movement. I think we're going to see a whole nother movement in the next few years.
I think you're absolutely right. And I actually love these conversations about culture creation, because I always try to like step back and take a look at what people are saying externally. And I see a lot of that, right? Like from other, for example, group practice owners, let's use that as an example for this podcast of like, nobody wants to work. We never get applications. Yes. Anyone that's here, you know, is so lazy and unmotivated. Everyone wants to work 15 to 20 hours a week. I think that COVID, and I say this on my other podcast a lot as a autistic ADHD human, was one of the best things that's ever happened to me. And I don't mean in the state of the world globally, but personally, to be, like you said, work from home, create my own accommodations, the recollection and realization of the typical workflow and infrastructure does not work for me. Mm-hmm. My sensory stuff is too overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And it was just like eye-opening for me. And as someone who employs, you know, 25, 30 humans, I try to think about that perspective all of the time of how can we create culture without taking advantage of people. There's always going to be a power dynamic shift with employer, employee, but how can we be super transparent, accommodate people's needs and necessities as dignified humans without jumping to conclusions of laziness, unproductive, unprofessional, whatever that narrative is. And there's a reason that our inbox stays full of applications every single month. And there is a reason that other people are really struggling to find quote unquote motivated workers who are not lazy.
And now we are going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors.
Hey everyone, it is the beginning of 2026, and I want to ask you a question. A year from today, what would your dream private practice look like? Would you spend less time chasing claims or only working with clients who value your skill set? What if you had a network to reach out to for questions or for free continuing education? And what if you had more time for yourself? This is why I've joined forces with Alma for the entirety of 2026, because Alma empowers you to confidently accept insurance backed by an all-in-one EHR that simplifies scheduling, documentation, and day-to-day practice operations. With a network of engaged providers and free CE courses, Alma makes it easy for you to build the practice of your dreams on your terms. Alma believes that when therapists get the support they need, mental health care gets better for everyone. Learn more about Alma at helloalma.com/ATPP. Your dream practice is closer than you think. Get started now at helloalma.com/ATPP.
And now we are going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors.
Hey everyone, this is Patrick from All Things Private Practice. I am inviting you to our third annual Doubt Yourself, Do It Anyway Summit. And guess what? This year it is in the United States, in beautiful Portland, Maine, not Oregon. I know there's a lot of confusion around that. Portland, Maine is a beautiful coastal city in the Atlantic Ocean. It's a harbor city. There's a lot of history there. It's very funky, very creative, very safe, walkable, lots of diversity. Very progressive city in the middle of Maine. It reminds me a lot of Asheville, North Carolina, where I live. A lot of cool small businesses. And that's exactly why we wanted to have it there. It's going to be September 1st to the 3rd. And you are going to get 9 MBCC CEs. We have ASWB pending. We'll make an announcement when that's finalized. 13 prolific industry leaders, really about doing things differently. The summit has always been about showing you that our skills are applicable in so many different ways and to motivate you to think bigger, to grow in this profession, to take more risks, to work through that self-doubt, and to really embrace the doubt yourself, do it anyway mentality. We're going to be talking about how to rewire your trauma histories so that they don't show up in your businesses. We're going to talk about neurodiversity affirming panels. We're going to have workshops on alternative income streams. We have so much involved in this event. So make sure to sign up. Spots are limited, September 1st to the 3rd. And again, beautiful Portland, Maine. And the link is in the show notes on my website and everywhere else that you follow my stuff. Doubt yourself, do it anyway. And I will see you in Maine.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the work that I do is around leadership behavior. Mm-hmm. And to your point, you've created a space where people can do their best work. And I think a main point of leadership is to create an environment, a climate for that to happen. Yeah. And oftentimes we don't think about leadership that way. We think about leadership as a title or place on an org chart or delegating work or telling people what to do, giving them direction. And we need to blow up that definition, that kind of command and control definition of leadership.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't work for human beings. It works for widgets and an assembly line and project planning. It doesn't work for complex human beings. And that's why having a degree in organizational psychology, when I come into an organization, it's like a whole new world I'm opening up to say, yeah, you need to know about the psychology of humans to lead them. And actually being a leader is a huge responsibility because you have somebody, I consider it a caregiver role. You have somebody within your care, a portion of their lives is in your care for a certain part of the day. And you either can send them home really fulfilled and happy, and or you can send them home harmed. You can harm people in the process of leading them. And people don't see the responsibility of that role. And that's a problem. And I think it just kind of, you know, when we think about all the culture work that we were just talking about, it just compiles on over time if you have bad leaders.
For sure. I mean, it certainly trickles down and it impacts and influences, it poisons the well, really, so to speak.
Exactly.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a part of conversations with organizations where it's like, Jesus, this is really toxic. And the only way out is to like really deconstruct everything we thought we knew and rearrange all of the leadership infrastructure. And that's where that pushback comes in, right? Like, that's where that resistance comes in, because it's like, oh, I feel threatened. Our entire existence could change. I always try to look at like the longevity and holistic health of an organization. And what does our retention look like? What does it mean when people are leaving? What reasons are they leaving for? Are they leaving because they feel disrespected, unsafe, unsatisfied? Or are they leaving because you've helped develop them into a human and employee and business owner who wants to go start their own business?
Yeah.
I think that's very different. I actually, I love Ted Lasso. I don't know if you watch the show.
Love. Yes. It's a lesson on leadership.
Yes. It's one of the best TV shows of all time for that reason, I think. And I'm doing a like 50th rewatch right now. And
it's good for the soul, you know, like, it's one of those
shows that you need in your life. I just think like it's so beautiful. And there's a scene where Keeley gets her like job offer to go start her own business. And she's talking to Higgins about her fear of telling Rebecca. And he's like, oh, because she's going to feel betrayed, or, oh, because, you know, you feel bad about leaving. And she's like, no, it's because she's my best friend and she gave me this opportunity. I don't want her to feel like I'm ungrateful. And he says something like, great leaders know you will move on, and better leaders help you move on and like, and hope that you do. And I think about that all the time and how I see so much possessiveness in culture sometimes of like, these are our employees. And it's like, no, they're fucking humans.
Yes. And if you look at the language we use at work, I'll name a few things for you. Okay. I've heard people talk about poaching when it comes to people. Like, are you going to poach that? It's kind of disgusting, actually. You know, we talk about human capital management. We use all these words and this language around possessiveness of people. And, you know, this is rooted probably in history that we could talk about on another podcast. But, we really think about people as a means to an end when it comes to the work. And so I agree with you 100%. There is also a sense of toxic loyalty. Even the idea of loyalty, I think, is something that doesn't belong in the workplace. It is a partnership, right? Yep. I say, for a certain period of time, I'm going to give you my talent, my time, my contribution, and you're going to exchange that for an experience and maybe some benefits and definitely pay, right? So, it is a partnership, and that agreement, that social contract as well, is the loyalty. But, you know, the thing that I have worked with a lot of family-owned businesses, and it's interesting because it's a family-owned business, but they want all their employees to be family. They're like, we're all family here, you know, that terminology. And that's really toxic because, first of all, families don't work together. They don't fire each other. They don't give each other performance reviews. Nope. They don't have to have tough feedback conversations about their work. It's an exploitation of the word loyalty, and employers will use it within the workplace to shame and guilt people into doing more for them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so exploitative, and like it creates this codependent toxicity of like, our employees have to rely on us for their, like, it's like, they're just doing a job, right? And ultimately, these are humans. And I can think about being in the reverse where I was an employee in middle management, which is the worst fucking place to be. And just feeling so dependent on that role and on that job and on the administration. And I remember when I finally built up the courage to leave and start my own business, I gave a fucking 90-day notice. Like, I was like,
generous.
My clients need me. My staff needs me. You know how fast they replaced me? It was 2 days, 2 freaking days. I was like dead man walking the whole time. I just remember like redacting that notice. But ultimately, I know what it feels like to feel that almost feeling of like dependency. And you feel really like this weird loyalty to this employer or organization or infrastructure who's not treating you well. It feels like an abusive relationship a lot of the time.
It does. It does. And, you know, that is something that is so prevalent. And again, and so anytime you see on a job description, we're like family here, just run the other way. Just know that from a workplace culture perspective, it sounds good, but, I don't know about you or any of the other listeners, but family can be toxic.
I'm not trying to work with a single member of my family. Relationships like that, where I have to see that person every single day. Absolutely. So that's a red flag. That's a good one. Do you have any other good ones that like come to mind where you're like, if you see this, get the hell out of there. Or if you're experiencing this, get the hell out of there.
You know, anything around work hard, play hard, hustle, people weaponize the word grit. I really have a problem with it. There's science and there's backing around the idea of grit and motivation. Angela Duckworth is a wonderful author. If you want to read her book about grit, do that, but reference it correctly and don't weaponize it. I think a lot of leaders, I see a lot of founders weaponizing this idea of grit.
Yeah.
And they kind of translated to, we're going to do whatever it takes to get the job done. Forget systems, forget working smart, forget building process. We're just going to grit it out. And that equals long hours, lack of inclusivity when it comes to working styles. Anything around grit, hustle, or work hard, play hard,
run for the hill. Yeah, I like that. The work hard, play hard one is good for sure. I'm going to think of more when we probably get off the air, because that's like, it's so funny to me because I audit like job postings and things for other organizations a lot. And I'm just, it's laughably bad. And I also we're not going to disclose the pay because we're not feeling that good about what we're paying people. Or like,
illegal, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. It happens all the time where pay based on experience. Here's maybe a vague range of like salary that you might get. It's just, it feels so pyramid scheme-esque. It's like mainline marketer-esque. And it also feels so shady. And then so many staff go into an interview, they don't feel comfortable to talk about the money piece, and they just accept whatever's put in front of them. And in reality, it's like, wow, I didn't even know we could have conversations like this in a healthy way, because it's such a power dynamic.
And there's also things internally that, we've always been taught, don't ask people their pay.
Right.
I would highly recommend you ask people, your friends, your colleagues, what they get paid, because that's how you discover where inequities are happening. So we've created these rules, these norms that are just slowly being broken down, which I love, and it's way overdue.
Yeah, way overdue. And I think you're right. We'll see that pendulum swing. Probably going to see a lot of stuff come crumbling down in the next 5 to 10 years. It's long overdue, and it feels like it's just like bubbling beneath the surface right now.
Mm-hmm.
I've been watching all these like dystopian end of the world shows and movies, and I'm like, oh my God, could I survive it? I don't think I could. I don't think I have any skills that are valuable enough to survive it, but like, it makes me feel like we are on this verge of this precipice of like, things are never going to be the same.
Yeah, I agree with you. A show that's kind of aligned to that, and from a workplace perspective, I don't know if you watched Severance.
I couldn't get into it, but I know
it's kind of a slow burn. It's kind of a slow burn. You gotta hang in there. But it's interesting because workplace culture has been a centerpiece of broader culture over the last like 5 to 10 years. You know, we had like Office Space and The Office. We had Severance. We have like all these shows that are in the context of being in a workplace. The Paper just came out. So there's this kind of omnipresent, like that's when you know, I think you're on the verge of some kind of change, is when pop culture is starting to reference like the dystopian nature of what work is.
100%.
Severance is a tough one to get through, but if you have a chance to watch it and you have the patience, it's pretty interesting.
I can't get behind, what's the main actor's name? Adam McKay.
Oh yeah.
Maybe that's a lot. I don't know. I don't like him. So it's
I get it. He's not likable.
as the main character. And it's just like, it was just very confusing. So I default more to like workplace culture. Let's think about like the Ted Lasso world and like Abbott Elementary's of the world. And I'm like, I can get behind that way more.
I love that.
Okay. So I really enjoyed this conversation. I could have this all day. And
we'll do a part two.
I'm happy to do it. So I guess let's talk briefly about the conference or the big event that you host every year. And maybe I'm getting that wrong, but like, tell us a little bit about what that is and how that came to be, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So I have been in the conference circuit for about 10, 15 years as a speaker. Patrick, you probably can relate to this, but I found myself in spaces where we weren't having the right conversations that led to action. I have found that conferences tend to be more of a marketing machine than an actual place of gathering and collective action with the brain trust of people that you've brought together. The other piece is I saw a lot of inequities when it came to the conference circuit. Speakers not getting paid, some speakers getting paid more than others, no social responsibility around the event. And like, are we hiring? Can we pour our money into vendors who are small businesses for the community in which we're hosting the event? So all of that to say, I kind of got fed up around it. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to build my own responsible model around conferences, which is still in the process. I haven't perfected it yet, but more of a model that creates opportunity, equity, and a human experience that actually leads to collective action. So the Culture Impact Lab, it's our annual conference. We talk about topics at the intersection of workplace culture and social change and impact. So like some conferences like DEI or social change might be like one section. Right. That's all we talk about. So we are typically gathering people in spaces where we're focused on like human rights and what that looks like within workplace culture, but also more socially. So I call it the big C and the little C, because anything happening within workplaces mirrors what happens socially within broader culture. And workplaces are usually at the tail end of any kind of change. So we're really trying to bring people together to expedite that. And so we run it every May in Chicago. We're hoping to do more cities soon this is our third year. If you're interested in joining or learning more, you can find us at callforculture.com. So you can learn more about Call for Culture or the company or the conference with that website.
Love that. We'll have that in the show notes for everyone too, because that's definitely an amazing opportunity to go and learn and participate and be around people who get it and who are trying to do things differently. I think that's the big piece here, is like, not everybody out there is doing it this way, right? Like, so there are people who are really trying, leadership groups that are really good and really trying to figure out ways to better serve their staff and their communities. Yes. So I really love that and appreciate you sharing that as well. So anything else you want to leave listeners with that we'll link in the show notes as well?
No, I mean, callforculture.com is the main one. I'm also on socials. So @AngelaRoseHoward on Instagram and @callforculture. So please consider me a resource. Reach out if you're kind of on your own leadership journey, trying to figure, you know, starting your own practice, and you're starting to think about culture, which you really should be thinking about at the very beginning. So happy to be a resource and just very, very excited to continue these conversations and to be in your orbit, Patrick. So thank you.
Likewise. Again, Kendra, shout out. So yes. Thank you again. Well, thanks to everyone listening to the All Things Private Practice podcast. All episodes are out on Saturdays, all major platforms and YouTube. Like, download, subscribe, share. Make sure to join us in Portland, Maine for my third annual Doubt Yourself, Do It Anyway Summit, September 1st to the 3rd. Doubt Yourself, Do It Anyway. Do it. See you next week.